Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Joshua chapter 17, verses 1 through 18. I will entitle this chapter, The Daughters of Zelophehad, or more precisely, The Allotments of Land for the Daughters of Zelophehad. And our context is this: in our previous chapters 15 and chapter 16, we looked at allotments of land for Judah, Ephraim, and Manasseh on the west side of the Jordan. And this chapter is an interlude before the allotments are going to be done for the other seven tribes on the west of the Jordan. But before we get there, in this chapter, we've got to take problem of what happens when one of the descendants of Manasseh has nothing but daughters, no males to leave the land to. And so we'll look at that problem. So we start now in Joshua 17, 1 through 2. Now this was the lot for the tribe of Manasseh, for he was the firstborn of Joseph. To Machir, the firstborn of Manasseh, the father of Gilead, were allotted Gilead and Bashan. Those, of course, are the names of the geographical areas east of the Jordan. You wonder whether the geographical areas were named after the descendants of Manasseh, and I'm sure they were. And so Machir was allotted Gilead and Bashan because he was a man of war, says the NASB. The Holman Christian Study Bible says who was a man of war. That makes a lot more sense, because what does being a man of war have to do with inheriting a certain lot of land in your tribal division? It doesn't. Not for any reason I can tell. So we'll take the Holman Christian Study Bible. That's one more example, folks, of why the NASB is so woodenly literal. It should only, in my opinion, be used as a backup Bible, not as your primary go-to translation. Verse 2, so the lot was made for the rest of the sons of Manasseh. Once again, it's descendants of Manasseh, sons, another literally wooden translation that confuses one if you use the NASB. So the lot was made for the rest of the descendants of Manasseh, according to the Holman Christian Study Bible. So the lot was made for the rest of the descendants of Manasseh, according to their families, for the sons of Abiezer, and for the sons of Helek, and for the sons of Azrael, and for the sons of Shechem. That sounds interesting, Shechem. And for the sons of Hepher. Hepher is important here when we get to the story of the daughters of Zelophehad, and for the sons of Shemaiah. These were the male descendants of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, according to their families. Now you recall that Manasseh is one of the two sons of Joseph, as in Ephraim and Manasseh, and Joseph apparently not wanting to favor the older son Manasseh over Ephraim, maybe because his older brothers were favored over him and he didn't like it. Who knows, or maybe because Jacob himself was a younger son. Remember, he stole his birthright from Esau, the older son. But for whatever reason, Jacob crossed his hands when he was doing the blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh, and gave the blessing of the firstborn instead of to Manasseh, where it normally would have gone. He gave it to Ephraim instead. Now, in some ways, this showed that Jacob's blessing was going to favor Ephraim. I haven't figured out how that's happened yet. I'll talk about that in a minute. But as Adam Clark says, Manasseh was still the firstborn, and some think this is why he got a double portion, one on the east side and one on the west. It could be because he has a lot more numbers than Ephraim, as we'll see in just a minute. Here's what Adam Clark says, quote, "It was necessary to mark this because Jacob in his blessing did in a certain sense set Ephraim before Manasseh, though the latter, Manasseh, was the firstborn. But the place here shows that this preference did not affect the rights of primogeniture." Well, that just raises more questions in my mind. Well, if it didn't affect the rights of primogeniture, the switching of the hands and the blessing of Jacob in Genesis 49, then what exactly did it do? Now, this western allotment to the tribe of Manasseh is said to go to Machir, but that cannot mean Machir personally. It means Machir's descendants. Machir personally was too far back in the past. Remember, Abraham is right around 1900 BC or so, and 1406 is the traditional date for Joshua entering the land. So this is after 1406 BC, say 1400, so that's 500 years. So it goes Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, and then Machir. And then Machir goes Gilead, and then after Gilead comes all these Abiezer, Helek, and so forth, the other sons. So you're talking about Machir is a good ways back before we get to this point of the descendants of Machir inheriting this land, or Machir inheriting the land, but it's got to be Machir's descendants. This has already been described in Numbers 32, 39 through 40, that the sons or the descendants of Machir were going to get the land. It says in Numbers 32:39, the sons of Machir, the descendants of Machir, the son of Manasseh, went to Gilead. So Moses gave Gilead to Machir. Well, in verse 39, it's the sons of Machir. Verse 40, it's Machir. So there, we put the two together, and we see that Machir means the descendants of Machir got this land. To Machir is just a shorthand way of saying to the descendants of Machir. We see that in Deuteronomy 3:15. To Machir I gave Gilead. Now, it says that Machir was a man of war. Well, if Machir was an ancestor of the current descendants of Manasseh, if Machir, the son of Manasseh, was back there a while, that means he could not have been a man of war on these on the conquest of the Canaan land. So, and because it was highly probable that he was dead before the Exodus, as John Gill says, and Gill says that he was a man of war, probably because, or probably by showing his warlike disposition fighting in the Egyptian army. Interesting speculation. Now in verse 2 it says, the lot was made for the rest of the descendants of Manasseh. That means for those on the west, because remember, those on the east had already gotten Gilead and Bashan. Some descendants of Manasseh had already gotten Gilead and Bashan, and this is the rest of the descendants of Manasseh who are going to get the half Manasseh on the west side of the Jordan. We go now to verses 3 through 6, and we take up the story of the daughters of Zelophehad. However, Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, had no sons. So here's how the descendant goes. It goes, Joseph had Manasseh, Manasseh had Machir, Machir had Gilead, Gilead had Hepher, Hepher had Zelophehad. And then Zelophehad had no son, he had only daughters. And these are the names of his daughters, Mahla and Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. They came near before Eleazar the priest and before Joshua the son of Nun. Remember, Eleazar is the currently serving high priest, the oldest surviving son of Aaron. Came before Joshua the son of Nun and before the leaders of the 12 princes, as the old commentators say, the 12 tribal leaders. They're listed by name. I'm not going to list them again, but they're listed by name in Numbers 34:17-29. So the tribal leaders, Eleazar and the priest, they're the judicial, they're the supreme court at the time. So the daughters of Zelophehad came before this court and said this, the Lord commanded Moses to give us an inheritance among our brothers. So according to the command of the Lord, he gave them an inheritance among their father's brothers. Thus there fell 10 portions to Manasseh besides the land of Gilead and Bashan, which is beyond the Jordan, to the east of the Jordan. Because the daughters of Manasseh received an inheritance among his sons, and the land of Gilead belonged to the rest of the sons of Manasseh. So the distinction between east and west is made very clear here more than once. And there were 10 portions divided out to Manasseh and to the descendants of Manasseh on the west side of the Jordan. Now, I mentioned that the leaders of Israel were along with Eleazar and Joshua when the apportionment was given to Manasseh's descendants. Those 10 leaders were named in Numbers 34:17-29. They were particular leaders. They had names. I'm not going to read them off to you. Now, before this tribunal, the daughters of Zelophehad very confidently state that the Lord had commanded Moses to give them an inheritance. Well, when did that happen? That had happened back in Numbers 27:1-10. We can read the whole story. I'll read you the first two verses of that passage. The daughters of Zelophehad approached. Zelophehad was the son of Hepher, son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, from the clans of Manasseh, the son of Joseph. These were the names of his daughters, Mahla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. They stood before Moses, Eleazar, the priest, the leaders, and the entire community at the entrance to the tent of the meeting. So this was a big deal that had already been decided before, and Joshua is asked, along with Eleazar and the tribal princes, is asked to do what Moses had told them to do, and what God had told Moses to do. So they had a strong case. Verse 5, thus there fell 10 portions to Manasseh. How did that happen? Well, there were 6 portions for the 6 families. The families were Ebezer, number 1, Helek, number 2, Asriel, number 3, Shechem, number 4, Hepher, number 5, Shemaiah, number 6. All right, so you divide the land up into 6 portions. Hepher's had a 1/6 portion. He had 5 daughters. Well, he had Zelophehad, who had 5 daughters. And so Hepher's portion was divided up into 5 portions. So you add the 5 sons to the 5 sons of Manasseh to the 5 daughters of Zelophehad, and you get 10 portions. No problem with the math there. So we now go to Joshua 17, verses 7 through 11, and we see the border of Manasseh running from Asher to Michmethath, which is east of Shechem, and then when the border went southward, it describes how the border runs. The border of Manasseh, I'm not going to go through that. Some of the towns might be familiar if you picked up on the geography as we've been going through this. But let me just look at a map real quick. We're looking at western Manasseh. If you look at Carmel, the Jezreel Valley running northwest to southeast, down from Mount Carmel to Beth Shan in the Jordan River Valley, just south, I don't know, maybe 10, 15, 20 miles south of the Sea of Galilee where Beth Shan is. That's the northern border of Manasseh. The eastern border is the Jordan River all the way down to somewhere around, well, there's nothing on the map to indicate where it might, somewhere around Shechem, let's say. And then you go, the head of the Yarkon River is around Shechem, and that goes northeast to southwest to the Mediterranean coast, enters into the Mediterranean Sea near Joppa, and that's the southern boundary of western Manasseh. And then you go north from Joppa all the way up to Mount Carmel. The western boundary of Manasseh is the Mediterranean Sea. Now we go to verses 12 and 13, but the sons of Manasseh could not take possession of these cities because the Canaanites persisted in living in that land. The cities is referring to all the cities that I didn't read to you. Towns such as Dor and Megiddo, towns like the other towns which maybe have been lost or we haven't mentioned. But Manasseh couldn't take possession of those cities because the Canaanites persisted in living in that land. It came about when the sons of Israel became strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely. Now, why did they not drive them out completely? If you think about it, that's a monumental task to take people who are living in a city and to kick them completely out of the city. That's real tough to do. Well, options as to why they didn't do it, they didn't have enough strength to do it. Option number one. Option number two is they were negligent and slothful, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest. But Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest that they got soft and they had a mistaken sense of humanity and says, oh, we're not going to drive them out of their cities. Well, for whatever reason, by waiting to take the cities, those cities later became too strong and numerous to drive out, at least for a time. Now Manasseh put the cities that they couldn't conquer, they put the inhabitants to forced labor. They made them slaves, as John Gill says, but they were rather commanded to kill the Canaanites, not make them slaves. John Gill speculates that probably they didn't want to kill them because they wanted their forced labor as slaves for the sake of gain. Again, speculations. Now they had been ordered to drive out the Canaanites. Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 2, where the Lord your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it, and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, and the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God delivers them before you, and you defeat them, you shall, quote unquote, utterly destroy them. Now, of course, it's debated what utterly destroy means. Most people say it means to kill all the male soldiers. Not necessarily, though. Some people say it doesn't mean that. It just means destroy the city as an ongoing geopolitical entity. Deuteronomy continues in verse 2, chapter 7, you shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. So again, I think it's debatable exactly how disobedient the tribe of Manasseh was by making the inhabitants slaves rather than killing them or putting them into exile. Deuteronomy 20, verse 16 through 17 uses that phrase, utterly destroy. Only in the cities of these people that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes. Ooh, not leave alive, that you shall utterly destroy them. And again, that depends on how you interpret that language. That's controversial. It does sound like on the face of it, they were supposed to execute the male soldiers, as well as the women and children and the old and infirm. And they didn't do it. And so they had a lot of trouble later on when the Canaanites sprang back up. In fact, when the Canaanites give the Israelites trouble in the land, which they're going to do for a long, long time, you could trace it back to the fact that the Israelites didn't extirpate the Canaanites in the land when they had the chance. So that basically leaves us two options as to whether the Manassites were culpable. One group of people said, yes, they were culpable. They were guilty. They could have done this now. They could have driven them out. Because they had become strong, it says in verse 13, it came about when the sons of Israel became strong, in our chapter here, Joshua 17, when the sons of Israel became strong, they could have done it then, says this argument. If they were strong enough to make them pay tribute or to make them become slaves, they were strong enough to drive them out. But another point of view says, no, the Manassites were not culpable. And I don't have the scholar who says this, but he translates the passage like this: "But the children of Manasseh could not resolve to destroy those cities, but the Canaanites consented to dwell in the land." In other words, the Manassites tried to kick the Canaanites out, but they failed, and so they're not culpable. They're not guilty of negligence because they did the best they could. I don't know what the answer to that weighty problem is. We go now to Joshua 17, verse 14. "Then the sons of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, 'Why have you given me only one lot and one portion for an inheritance, since I am a numerous people whom the Lord has thus far blessed?'" Now, the sons of Joseph are Ephraim and Manasseh, but this is a little bit ambiguous. You could read the sons of Joseph as the children of Manasseh only, because it says, "You've given me only one lot." And Manasseh was very numerous, which we'll see when we look at the numbers here in just a minute. In other words, it seems like if both Manasseh and Ephraim are speaking here, they would have said, "You've only given us two lots." John Gills says that if you want to look at the sons of Joseph as both Manasseh and Ephraim, you can handle this problem of one lot by pointing out that the inheritance which had come to them by lot had not yet been divided. In other words, it was the lot for Ephraim and Manasseh, one lot. And that lot was not enough for both tribes, not just for one tribe, but both tribes. However, John Gill says that that's not what it means when it says the sons of Joseph. It means both the tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim, and I think he's right. We go to Joshua 17, verse 17. A few verses later, it says, "Joshua spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh." So Joshua speaking to both tribes, the son, house of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. "You are a numerous people." All right, so let's assume that's true. Manasseh and Ephraim are telling Joshua, "Hey, we're a numerous people." Well, let's look at the numbers here. There was a census in the second year of the Exodus, right at Mount Sinai, in Numbers chapter 1, and then in the 40th year of the Exodus in Numbers 26, they had a second Exodus. So if you look at the numbers, Ephraim at the first census and at Mount Sinai, Numbers 1, Ephraim had 40,500 people, men, of war, and Manasseh had 32,200. Well, that's a good bit of advantage for Ephraim, but by the time you get to year 40, after 38 years of wandering in the desert, Ephraim has 32,500 and Manasseh had 52,700, a huge flip. So yeah, they've become very numerous now and they need more land. So that's the problem now before Joshua. Before we go to see how Joshua solves this problem, let's look again at these numbers. This is something interesting to me. We know in Genesis 49 that Jacob switched the inheritance from Manasseh, the oldest son of Joseph, to Ephraim, the youngest son. He switched the blessing, if you will. Well, so my question then becomes, well, then what does that mean in history? How has Ephraim been blessed more than Manasseh? Well, it's interesting. You look up Ephraim Manasseh on the internet, and you got tons of articles about why Jacob did the switch, but you can't find anything about what happened to show that Ephraim was blessed more than Manasseh. Well, it can't be population, because Manasseh has completely outclassed Ephraim in population. It can't be territory, because Manasseh ends up with more land. He ends up with land both east and west of the Jordan. Just the western part of Manasseh, if you look at the map, is bigger than Ephraim's part. So it can't be territory. I saw one blogger who said the way that Ephraim was blessed over Manasseh was that Joshua was from the tribe of Ephraim, and since Joshua was the leader of Israel, that shows that Ephraim was more blessed. And that actually is plausible, although I don't think it's dispository of the question. It's an interesting issue. I'll put it on my theological bucket list and see if I can come up with an answer sometime in the future. Unfortunately, you will not get to hear it on this podcast. Joshua 17, assuming I find out the answer. Joshua 17, 15. "Joshua said to them, 'If you are a numerous people, go up to the forest and clear a place for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and of the Rephaim, since the hill country of Ephraim is too narrow for you.'" Now, Jameson Foster Brown says that what Joshua does here is being sarcastic. "Well, then, if you're so numerous, why don't you go up and take your numbers and clear out the forest here where the bad guys are living, where the Canaanites are living, and make yourself a land big enough? If you're so numerous as to need more land, then therefore you are numerous enough to go take the land, especially since the land is already within your allotted borders. As John Gill says, the land was near them and within their borders and lay on hills and mountains." Well, I don't think that necessarily is so. That's a speculation, but it could be that Joshua's telling them straight, "Hey, look, I realize your problem here, In fact, I think he's talking straight. I don't think he's being sarcastic. I realize you got a lot of people and you got a lot of forest to clear, but go clear the forest and get rid of these Canaanites and you'll have enough land. Now, when it says go up to the forest, that's referring to the forest that's on the hill country. The hill country was covered with forest, and the hill country is that spine of mountains that goes all the way up to the north of Israel, all the way down to the Negev, right south of Jerusalem, if you look at the map. Now, that spine of mountains is interrupted by the Jezreel Valley up there as you're getting toward the Sea of Galilee, but basically it's a one long ridge of mountain peaks. And they're not high mountains, they're hills. That's why they call it the hill country. It's not really mountains. It's not like the Rocky Mountains. And they were covered with forest. And so Joshua is telling Ephraim and Manasseh to go up and clear those forests, and your land, your allotment of land, will be fine. But you're going to have to fight for it. He mentions a couple of people in particular. He mentions the Perizzites. I'm going to assume that they are southwest of Carmel up there, because that's right in Manasseh's territory. I saw one map that had some Perizzites further south down toward the Shephelah. But of course, remember, these tribes are scattered all over Israel, and so they're not necessarily going to be in just one place. But I suspect that the Perizzites here are being referred to are the Perizzites near Mount Carmel, because again, that's in Manasseh's territory. And of the Rephaim, they're scattered everywhere. Whenever you see Rephaim, think giants. The Rephaim are sometimes called Zamzumin by the Ammonites. They're sometimes called Emim by the Moabites. Some people even say they're related to those aboriginal giants in Genesis 6, the Nephilim. The Anakim sometimes are referred to as giants too. They're all, just remember, you see those words, aboriginal giants, don't worry too much that the scholars don't know too much about them. So Joshua casually says, well, just go knock off some giants and you got your land. Joshua was a bold man. He didn't expect the people following him to be cowards or timid either. Now, Easton's dictionary says this hill country of Ephraim that the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh are told to go take, that hill country extended to the plain of Jezreel down to Bethel. I had it a little bit longer than that. Okay, we'll stop it at the plain of Jezreel and stop it, instead of going all the way down to the Negev, stop it right around Bethel, which is right north of Jerusalem. Easton says, in Joshua's time, these hills were densely wooded. They were intersected by well-watered, fertile valleys. Joshua was buried at Timnath-Heres among the mountains of Ephraim, the hill country of Ephraim. Sometimes that phrase is called the mountains of Israel rather than the hill country of Israel. Rather than the hill country, it's called the mountains of Israel and the mountains of Samaria. And all those loose geographical terms can be clarified. If you just look at a map, you can see, oh, that's obvious what they're talking about. We go down to verse 16. The sons of Joseph said, the hill country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites who live in the valley land have chariots of iron, both those who are in Bethshan and its towns and those who are in the valley of Jezreel. We're going to assume that when he says the Canaanites in the valley land, he's talking about the valley of Jezreel. If you look at Mount Carmel, go northwest, go southeast, the valley of Jezreel slices the hill country and goes to the Jordan River Valley, famous valley there. And the Canaanites there have chariots of iron. Now, that means, as John Gill says, that scythes, curved blades, is what is referred to, suggests that that's what it's referred to, blades attached to the axles of the chariots to cut down infantry. Well, that would make sense. Or it could be chariots strengthened with iron, but not made completely of iron. The reason for that is no horse is going to pull a chariot of iron across the rough countryside. You know that's not going to happen, because iron's too heavy. And the sons of Joseph and Manasseh mentioned that the Canaanites are in Bethshan and other towns there in the valley of Jezreel. Again, Bethshan is the town right at the end of the valley of Jezreel, at its southeast extremity. That is right near the mountains of Gilboa. It's right around where Saul got killed when we get to the story of Saul. We go now to Joshua 17, verses 17 through 18, and we'll finish this audio. Joshua spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, you are a numerous people and have great power. You shall not have one lot only, but the hill country shall be yours. For though it is a forest, you shall clear it, and to its farthest borders it shall be yours. For you shall drive out the Canaanites, even though they have chariots of iron and though they are strong. In other words, Joshua's saying, quit telling me about the Rephaim, the giants are there. I don't care. Don't tell me about the chariots of iron that the bad guys have. I don't care. Be brave. Go take them. Look at me. I've been very brave. Follow my example. Now notice that Ephraim is mentioned along with Manasseh here. when Joshua says you're a numerous people, even though it's mainly Manasseh who's numerous. It was mainly Manasseh who was trying to expand. But Manasseh and Ephraim's interest in cities were intermixed. They were brethren. In fact, Manasseh was right north of south, the tribal allotment. Manasseh was right north of Ephraim. The two tribal allotments were adjacent to each other. So it would be to Ephraim and Manasseh's mutual advantage to expand. Now, there's a little problem with this phrase, one lot only. Joshua says, okay, guys, we're going to give you more than one lot, is basically what he's saying. But the problem is the lot had already been cast. And it seems to me that giving Joshua another lot would be invalidating the lot that had already been cast. A possible answer to my little problem there is Joshua saying here, you will not only have the portion you have presently occupied, but you will have more of your allotment if you'll go out and take it. And I think the context, that's really what this phrase means in context. You shall not have just the portions of one lot that you have already, but you'll have the whole lot if you'll go out and take it. Now, Joshua gives them this huge hunk of the western side of the Jordan River, and it says it's yours, but we never hear whether they actually took it. Did they ever take the advice of Joshua and go take that land? We don't know. History does not tell us. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Joshua chapter 17. That prepares us to go to Joshua 18, our next chapter, and we will look at the division of the remaining seven tribes that are left. Reuben, Gad, and eastern Manasseh are taken care of. Western Manasseh and Ephraim are taken care of, as well as Judah. So that's five tribes. Seven more to go. And this allotment for the remaining seven tribes, all of whom are on the west side of the Jordan, that's going to be carried out at Shiloh as Joshua moves the camp from Gilgal down there in the southeast all the way to Shiloh, which is more north central, the more north central area of Israel. So we'll see that in our next chapter. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this one.